Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. This is Travis, and I'm back in the saddle to talk about student debt by the generations today. But this would be kind of a fun hybrid episode where we talk about actual statistics about what's going on with student loan debt, just in general, across the decades, really, and talk about the composition of student loan debt just by age, and talk about the current state of the IDR waiver slash IDR account adjustment, and talk a little bit about why the administration felt like it was so necessary. First, I just want to talk about I'm going to call this the AARPification of federal student loans. In 2017, not that long ago, about 6 years ago, 4% of student loan debt was owed by people over the age of 62. Now that's 8%. If we look at age over 35, and I know that doesn't qualify for AARP, but you know, the point is that if you were over 35, then you owed 54% of all student debt in 2017. Now that's up to 78%. $4 in $5 of student loan debt is now owed by people above the age of 35. That's pretty concerning, because if you think about what that means, what do you do in college, right? You go to college 22 to 26, give or take. Oh, man, my brain's not working. Oops. I was thinking medical school and dental school and things like that, right? I'm going to blame my my two kids being sick constantly for my lack of sleep for that oversight. 18 to 22, you're in college, right? And most people will do grad school sometime in their 20s. You know, if you think about what 35 means, if you're 35 and you have student loan debt, in most cases, that means you probably have been done with school for, on average, more than 10 years. And $4 and $5 of student loan debt is owed by that demographic. So that's like very concerning, I think. If you think about maybe even 20 years ago, I don't think you heard a lot of stories about people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s owing student loan debt. That was kind of a thing. You came out, maybe you owed a small amount, but you paid it off quickly, and then it was done. If you think about student loan debt in general, back in, say, the 40s, 50s, and 60s, you really didn't hear about student loan debt at all. And why is that? Well, let's talk about the 40s. In the 40s, for the most part, if you were white and male, you probably weren't going to college. Not completely true, but for the most part, kind of true in terms of just the traditional colleges, right? You did have, obviously, HBCUs that admitted African-American students, but you know, colleges were fairly segregated. And if you think about 40s, 50s, and 60s, you had very cheap schools. It was not super expensive to go. One of my granddad's family lore stories is when he was trying to go to community college in the 30s, his first brother, the first brother in the family, they sold the family plow, and they took that money, and that was enough to get them into community college. And then he went and worked odd jobs, that brother did, and then sent money home to send the next kid to community college. And they did that for the entire family. And that's how they were able to fund all those children going to college. Now, my granddad went to college in Mississippi. If he had been black, that would not have been possible to have that story. So if you think about access to higher education was quite constrained back then. And so what happened in 57, Sputnik, the higher education kind of industry, I guess you could call it, it wasn't as much of an industry then. And the government decided, hey, we need to make a partnership and get more people in STEM education. We need to be able to compete with the Soviets in the Cold War. So that suddenly a college education wasn't sort of just a novelty or a nice to have. It was a necessary part of national defense to go up against the Soviets. So the federal government for the first time got directly involved in the student loan market and expanded credit to people who would want to go to college. Before that, the government obviously got involved in college financing through the GI Bill, but it wasn't really available to people who were not veterans, right? So this new way of doing things after Sputnik was available to basically anybody. Anybody could get loans, or at least more people could get loans. What happened after that is you had a government guaranteed lending program. The FFEL loan program in some version was around all the way up until about 2010. What was this program? Basically, the private lenders would issue the loans, government would guarantee them, and would guarantee certain interest on them and everything. And that was a system that lasted for quite a long time, but it got killed off in 2008, and then they phased it out by 2010 with under the Obama administration. Essentially, the student loan program, for the most part, got nationalized, right? So we had the FFEL program go away, and then it was just the direct loan program. And if you look at what's happened to the loan portfolio, the cost of tuition, the breakdown of who owes what by what age, I mean, it's just quite staggering, right? So clearly what's happened is the amount of debt owed by people that are older has drastically increased. And that kind of makes sense because overall you've seen uptake on income-driven repayment plans go up, and those programs require you to be in debt for a long time to get it forgiven. So it kind of would make sense that as the system sort of more encourages income-driven repayment, that the portfolio of student loans would age. But there's a couple reasons for that, right? So if you think about people in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s even, you know, you did have higher support for state universities from state governments. I think part of that is because there's fewer students. So it's kind of cheaper to do that with. And, you know, so I think that you had low costs for tuition. I also think that you had way less administrative bloat. I think you did not have gyms that look like Olympic gyms for student gyms, right? You didn't have student centers that look like the Pantheon or the Parthenon or something like that. That part of the reason that college was so cheap in the period of our, I guess, my parents' age is because you didn't have a lot of these add-ons and frills and extra programs and services like you do now. So part of the story of student debt by the generations is when the cost of something soars, so does the debt to finance it if you're financing it through debt. And Americans, that's really how we finance higher education. You do not really see a massive contribution to the education sector like you do the healthcare sector through something like Medicare, right? Now, there is big investments with things like Pell Grants and others, but it's not nearly to the same scale as something like Medicare or Social Security. Now, let's talk about the number of people that have been in debt a very long time. And, you know, I apologize again if this episode kind of seems like it doesn't have a super clear view, but I thought that it would be kind of interesting just to talk about a lot of different factors of student debt and age and just across the decades, just sort of talking really about history of student loan debt and just the composition of student loan debt. Anyways, I'm going to just keep coming back to blaming my lack of sleep as parent to anything that doesn't make sense in pod, but I hope you enjoy it. So the numbers in the IDR waiver, December 2020, there were 4.4 million people who'd been in debt for at least 20 years with $211 billion debt in total. Now, this is the same definition that they're using in the IDR waiver as it was used in this letter that Senator Warren sent to the Department of Education. This is, you know, kind of really evidence that Senator Warren and sort of her mentees, if you will, or people who I guess would be people that she's promoted into positions of power in DC. This is like proof that she, I think, was the mastermind behind the IDR waiver. Because what happened is you're defining the 4.4 million people who've been in repayment for at least 20 years. You're defining that based off of when they took out the very first loan ever, right? Not what is the weighted average credit they have. But you say, what is the weighted average credit of how long you've been in repayment? You know, my guess is instead of being 4 million people with $200 billion of debt, it maybe would be like 1.5, maybe, you know, $80 billion of debt or something like that. This number is interesting, though, because it does truthfully state how long has somebody had a student loan outstanding, right? And still has a student loan outstanding. So in other words, if you paid off your student loan completely from undergrad and then you took out more debt from grad school later, then you would not fall into this you've had student debt for 20 years category. It is somewhat accurate too, and it's just a lot of different ways to slice numbers in politics. So in addition to the 4 million people that have been in debt for 20 years, there's 10 million people who have been in debt 10 to 20 years, and that's about $450 billion of debt. So if you do some math, because this was done in December of 2020, if you add on essentially the pro rata amount of 10 million people with $450 billion of debt, factor in that it's been maybe about, goodness sakes, can barely do math these days, but, you know, 2.5 years. It's been about 2.5 years, so you'd say about maybe 2.5 million people, and then you maybe would have maybe $100 billion-ish of student loan debt to tack on to that. That's kind of interesting, right? That's like $300 billion of debt that's been around for at least 20 years as of now. And a lot of this could be discharged soon. So a lot of this could be discharged soon with the IDR waiver. And this is what's so interesting is if you look at the PSLF waiver, about $140 billion at least was eligible. Only about $24 billion or so got forgiven. Now, that's not the full cost because that is going to continue to be processed during this IDR waiver. So the final number is probably going to be larger than this. But it's still, I think, an indication that the program, you know, you could argue the program failed. because you're trying to get all these people benefits to PSLF. What you really did is deliver it to people that have more resources, more education, more ability to navigate bureaucracy. IDR waiver is not that dissimilar. To get the IDR waiver, you have to know to consolidate your loans in many cases. So particularly this is true for people who have had debt for 20 years. So if you think about having debt for 20 years, a lot of this debt's going to be FFEL. Why is that? Because there was no, well, there were direct loans issued before 2010, but they weren't nearly as large as the FFEL loan program, which is the one that doesn't qualify unless you consolidate. So probably a majority of these people that could qualify for cancellation if they consolidated have this ineligible type of loan and will therefore not be forgiven. So out of $300 billion that could be forgiven, perhaps if you look at the PSLF waiver as evidence, you might say $100 billion, $120 billion. Certainly, I don't think a majority would be forgiven from the IDR waiver. And that's actually, you know, pretty concerning. The truth of student loans, right, is that a lot of people have been in debt a long time with these student loans. And as just the incentives have encouraged people to stay in debt for a long period of time instead of aggressively paying it off, the average age of a borrower has gone up. And if you look at just generationally, our parents that went to college didn't have to take out very much debt at all, whereas we have to take out quite a bit of debt. And partly, again, that's because colleges have had reduced support from state governments and federal governments and such. But it's also because colleges are making what I think would be fair to say are questionable financial decisions. I actually remember there was an article I published several years ago about, I think it was, I can't quote this for sure, but I think it was like University of New Hampshire or something like that. And they bought I think it was like an $11,000 or $12,000 table for their student union, just like put it in a random spot. Now, it was a piece of art, I think. It was a really nice table. But when you've got universities putting, you know, tables that cost the amount of a used car into a student center, that kind of like care of finances and just being frugal and being prudent with money, it's completely absent in higher education. When I went to college, there was a campaign to expand and renovate the student union, and they were going to spend a ton of money and raise tuition to do so. And it's sort of like, well, what's the point? Why would you spend all this extra money on the student union if you're wealthy, from a wealthy family, you don't mind paying for that expense? Sure, but you know, my college roommate was completely funding his school through loans, and his family was first generation to this country, and they didn't necessarily have all those resources. And for him, it doesn't matter how nice the student union looks, just get me a good job that I can actually earn a good income with. Anyways, it's kind of interesting to think about just how higher education has become this thing that has to be kind of upscale now, where I think it used to sort of be a little bit more just go get your degree and it doesn't matter where you get it. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong in that. But one interesting thing is with the student loan program, it definitely expanded access, which is a really wonderful thing, right? If you think about, you know, again, the story of my granddad going to community college in the rural South, not okay that a lot of other people that didn't look like him couldn't get access, right? So that's a good thing that you've got all people able to go to college. Now, the interesting thing is, so when the program for the guaranteed student loans ended, around the same time, they also created Grad Plus, which eliminated caps on borrowing. And you really saw some really interesting things. So, you know, some examples. Pharmacy schools, the number of pharmacy schools tripled before Grad Plus and until now. So obviously way more access for anybody that wants to go to school can go to school. But what's interesting is the expanded access came at a pretty hefty price. So the schools drastically increased their prices, really. And there's a recent paper that is specifically mentioning the Grad Plus program, and it really found pretty horrific data on the Grad Plus program as policy. So essentially, the authors found no impact on graduation rates, the racial or gender mix of enrollment, and no impact on increasing earnings from the Grad Plus program. So essentially, if you basically have no benefits from it, then what exactly is the benefit of having the Grad Plus program, which allows people to borrow unlimited amounts? And frankly, you know, for our clients, also is one of the key reasons why people end up with really large six-figure balances of student loans. If you think about it, basically what's happening is that Grad Plus program probably doesn't benefit society a ton if it doesn't increase graduation rates or increase access or increase diversity of the students that attend grad schools. Who is it helping mostly? Well, it's definitely helping the schools primarily. And secondarily, it helps those get people who are going to buy graduate degrees, it helps them buy them cheaper because it's shifting the cost from private student loans to federal student loans, which are increasingly more and more generous and more able to be forgiven. So that's a huge change across the generations. Private student loans were the key way that people paid for school for a long, long time, but it's becoming less and less and less that way. Now, what about Parent PLUS loans? Those are also uncapped. Here's an interesting kind of historical note. President Obama tried to cap Parent PLUS loans. He tried to eliminate the ability for people to borrow 200, 300, 400,000 of Parent PLUS loans because he thought that that was too high of an amount, or his administration thought that was a too high of an amount for somebody to be able to pay back, especially given Parent PLUS loans don't have access to things like revised pay as you earn. They're just able to pay 10%, 20% of their income, right? Unless you know all these loopholes. But he faced opposition, President Obama did, from HBCUs specifically, who warned the Obama administration that they would go out of business if the administration capped Parent PLUS. Why? HBCUs don't have huge state support. They don't have huge endowments. So their families, on average, are less wealthy and would get screwed over more with high private student loan interest rates if the federal government did not make credit available through the federal student loan program, right? So that was an important way for the HBCUs to stay in business. But the problem is our Byzantine Parent PLUS system really kind of rewards someone who can get access to someone like us to sort of go through the Parent PLUS double consolidation process and help somebody pay less, right? The best way to fund HBCUs would be grants and minority-serving institutions. If you could just increase Pell Grants, that would be much, much better. But Congress can't agree on that. And so then everybody kind of uses this back door of, well, let's make more generous IDR plans. Let's not shut down the Parent PLUS double consolidation loophole. It's kind of a weird situation, right? So sort of like everybody's sort of looking at the way, pretending there's not a problem, and there's a really big problem, because all of this money that's being spent on schools could probably be more efficiently spent, right? You probably could come up with some sort of increased Pell Grant setup and maybe eliminate some of the, or at least cap some of the most extreme cases, you know, of dental schools charging $500,000 that maybe they'd only need to charge $300,000 by putting more regulation on the schools, right? That doesn't seem like it's going to happen anytime soon. The value of a college degree has gone up a ton over the generations. So if you think about, you know, the famous story is, you know, in the 50s, you could get a factory job at GM and make a middle-class wage. That person could do that, then going and getting a middle-level bachelor's degree in business is not really that attractive comparatively. But now the factory union wage that's middle class, that's really hard to come by in a lot of cases. And if you can't get that, then suddenly the, you know, return from getting an education looks better because essentially the wages that you can get from a college education are much higher than not doing it. So the value of a degree has gone up a lot over time. What has happened with that value? So there's a term in economics called producer surplus and consumer surplus, which basically says that, you know, the provider of the good gets part of the benefit and the consumer of the good gets part of the benefit. And so what happened is the schools, even though they're technically not for profit in most cases, they are very much for profit actors. And the schools decided that they wanted to capture a whole lot of that value internally for themselves, right? In the form of more people working at the school, in the form of higher salaries for the administration and people leading the schools. So also students gain some of this value too, right? Obviously people are making more money, getting the benefits of their degrees. I think that the rising student loan debt over the generations, is this a major, major crisis? Well, it's a huge problem. In terms of, is student debt a crisis? I mean, it's not to the level of Medicare, Social Security. That's going to be tens of trillions of dollars to fix, either in new taxes or lower spending or some combination of both, right? Whereas the student debt crisis, you could cancel all the debt tomorrow and it would be a big deal, but it wouldn't be a massive deal in terms of, in comparing it to other things, fixing other things, right? And because I think that the problem can continue to be put off, which is really what happens with student loan debt, over the generations, basically every administration looks at student loans and says, this is not that important. I want to focus on defense. I want to focus on domestic programs. student loan debt is this sort of nuisance, and I'll come back and deal with it later. And really, it's the Biden administration who's really the first administration that has paid attention to student loan debt. Maybe that's not fair. Obama administration certainly paid attention to it a lot. But I would say the Biden administration, I think, is the first administration to think about student loan debtors like in a sort of a political ROI perspective. You know, I think that the Obama administration curtailed some student loan benefits with the repay program by not allowing people to file taxes separately. So I think the Obama administration also talked about capping PSLF, capping Parent Plus. It was a little bit more of a, I think, a policy wonk kind of a discussion in the Obama administration, whereas I think Biden administration is a lot more like, could this help us in the midterms if we did X? Could we potentially have a better chance at getting nominated in 2024 if we do student debt cancellation? I think that that's what's really interesting. And the question is if you're having more of a political ROI now, does that mean that when a Republican president eventually takes office, does that Republican think of this also in political terms about, well, maybe I don't want to take away benefits because that will cause a political backlash, so it's better for me not to touch my predecessor's actions? Or is it viewed as like political retribution to, you know, strike down a lot of programs and rein things in? Really going to be interesting to see this. And also, will future Democratic administrations, future Democratic presidents after President Biden, will those presidents be really aggressive with student loans too? Will they be more aggressive with federal student loans? I think it's going to be real interesting to see, because I think that, you know, if you try to predict things, if you have parties that are very divided on educational levels like they are now, if that gets worse, where you have highly educated voters even more go to the Democratic Party and lower educated voters go more to the Republican Party than they already are, you know, you will probably see a continued polarization on policy around student loan debt. And I think another reason why student loans across the generations have become a more potent political issue is because of the aging nature of a student loan debtor. As student loan debtors get significantly older, older voters have more political power. And so more and more people, politicians, right, pay attention when it gets them votes, and an older group of student loan borrowers gets them more votes. So I think another reason for the IDR waiver being the way it is because this is something that is kind of like fixing the bankruptcy rules around student loan debt. That's what they're trying to do, but they won't do it for some reason. And they're delivering benefits with the IDR waiver to older voters, which if you think about Medicare, Social Security, Medicare Part D for drug benefits, this is something that politicians are really good at doing. It's another reason why I think the tax bomb definitely doesn't happen. Because if you think about what happens with a tax bomb, most of people are going to owe this tax bomb in 2030 range. That's like the big amount of people that started income-based repayment in 2009. And, you know, 25 years after that is 2034. And so I think mid-2030s is when you're going to see a wave of tax bombs. That's in 10 years. Typical millennials will be in their 40s and 50s at that point. That's a median adult. That's a very valuable voter. You don't want to make that voter mad by having a tax bomb. You don't want your veterinarians, lawyers, chiropractors, pharmacists, private practice physicians. You don't want all these people in your community and your congressional district calling you and saying, hey, you have to end this tax bomb. I do not want to mortgage my house to pay taxes on a debt that I borrowed when I was 26. So that's one big reason politically, again, why I think you have to start thinking about student loan debt for future generations in terms of politics. So if I had a conclusion of today's podcast, I think that's probably it. Student loan debt used to be a problem of limited resources and opening access. And what's happened is since the government's gotten involved in student loan debt ever increasingly more, where it's not just a sideshow anymore, it's a major issue that's, you know, much lower than some issues, right? But it's still a major level caliber issue. You're going to see this genie not being able to be put back in the bottle, really. Once you have a big battle, political battle over student loan debt at the Supreme Court as to whether or not you can cancel it, this huge issue is going to come up. And as the costs in the budget go up and up and up, because it will, the, you know, reality of how much we're spending on student loans is going to sink in. And I'm not real sure what will happen. It could be that at that point, the interest group of student loan borrowers is so powerful that all those benefits are protected and not being able to be curtailed. It could be that as schools become wealthier and wealthier and wealthier and hire more and more and more people in congressional districts, that the schools will have so much political sway that Congress will be afraid to cut their funding or cap borrowing. And it could be that some sort of compromise is reached at some point where we say, okay, in exchange for more Pell Grants, in exchange for more funding for minority-serving institutions and HBCUs, we're going to curtail Parent Plus. We're going to put more regulation in place on schools. For the Grad Plus program, we're going to allow it for certain programs, but we're going to block it for the programs that are abusing it the most. So that could be something that comes down the pipeline at some point, but it might be a ways away. So in the near term, I think what will happen is we'll continue to see the tuition inflation that we've experienced in the past 20 and 30 years. I think it's going to continue, and I think it's not necessarily going to get worse in terms of the percentage increase of tuition. I don't think it's necessarily going to increase, because then you have an exponential type of problem. But I do think that for my children, I think that the college price that they'll pay is probably somewhere between 3 and 4 times what it is now. And that's pretty ridiculous, right? And at some point, there's some pushback from the folks who fund this, which is some families that actually pay straight up are going to push back on price. And then also, I think what's going to really happen is this Congress will start to balk at the level of spending that's being taken up by higher education in the budget. Long ways away from that, but I think that's what's going to happen. If you think about the graying of student loan borrowers overall, there's a lot of things that could be done on that. Right now, there's no limit on how old you can be to take out student loans. I don't know about public policy, but that seems like something that you probably don't want to allow an 80-year-old to take out student loans, right? I mean, probably that's not a good use of public resources. That money could go into things like home care assistance, right? It could go to early childhood education. It could go to a lot of other things, you know, instead of giving someone who, actuarially speaking, does not have many, many years left in the workforce to have that investment made in their education. Maybe if somebody wants to do that out of their own funds, that's fine. But like, that's kind of some of the interesting conversations we're going to have as a country, because I think more and more people are taking out student loans to have second careers. I think that's certainly good. I'm not saying that people shouldn't be able to do that. If you're 50 and you want to go back to school and take out federal student loans, great. You know, you could have a 20, 25-year, 30-year working career after that. But I do think some of these hard questions are going to have to be discussed as the cost of tuition has spiraled across generations and as student loan debt has spiraled across generations. Luckily, though, the IDR waiver is a major solution to this. So because they are counting credit on the consolidations based on the loan with most credit towards forgiveness, a lot of people need to be doing that right now. The thing that I wanted to bring up is a lot of people need to know what their credit should be on their consolidation. So a lot of, you know, the Department of Education doesn't have a great track record of having accurate data, right? So even if you think that you know you need to consolidate your loans, I think it would be useful to maybe look and see how much credit you should have towards forgiveness. And that's something that our team is experts at doing. So if you need help, studentloanplanner.com/book. Thanks for letting me get a little wonkish on today's episode. Just thought it would be kind of a fun thing to talk about, just with everything going on with student loan payments potentially restarting and just how the picture of student loan debt overall has changed over time. Thanks everyone for listening to today's podcast, and hope to see you soon.